it's working.
Hello?
There, yeah. There it's on. Yeah. Okay. Now it's really working.
Yeah.
We either have a little or a lot or none. Now we have a lot.
Okay, good.
Go ahead, sister.
Last month you talked about expectation and inspection, and we discussed how to apply that to the adult class.
Okay.
Because they are adults. They still have to fulfill some of the responsibilities, but we cannot treat them as children.
Okay.
So I designed some questions so that next time when they come back, they can use those questions as a guide. So they need to review the lessons and then answer those questions. And hopefully through the discussion, that will encourage them to read more. And the result, not so great.
Okay.
They still need more encouragement and maybe some prodding from fellow believers.
Okay, all right. Sometimes other members of the class can be the ones to kind of help to push and pull some of them along, okay? So you gave it a try. All right. Well, I hope you will continue. But that she is right. It's not just enough to expect. We have to inspect it. If we don't follow up, all of us are the same. If no one's going to follow up, we tend to just kind of lay it aside and not worry about it. If we know that someone's going to be following up, then we're more careful. I don't remember if I gave you the example last month of Paul and Philemon. But when he writes to Philemon about Onesimus, he says at the end of the letter, I am praying that I'll be released from prison, and when I am released, I will come visit you. Now, he doesn't need to say it, but Philemon knows when Paul comes, what will he be checking? Where is Onesimus? How did you treat Onesimus? And so he follows up. And sometimes I think a danger of teaching is we say, this is what I want you to do, but we don't follow up with it. So, good. All right, anyone else? This is my time of inspecting what I gave you last time. So. Okay, I'll give you something at the end of today, and hopefully some more of you will report next month when we meet. In a book on teaching, Howard Hendricks says, and I'm really having trouble with all the technology today. I think whatever turned the mics on turned off the PowerPoint. I can choose one or the other, but not both. Like being on an airplane, and they say we can either run the right engine or the left engine, but not both. Well, I'm going to continue.
See, that works.
Nothing is happening. Well, that's okay. I'm going to continue. In a book, there, now it's working. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
In a book about teaching, Howard Hendricks says that very often teachers are tempted to think, what do I need to focus on the most, my message or the method? And he says some teachers are very good at the method. They are very creative at coming up with ideas of how to teach. But he says sometimes they are teaching nothing beautifully. That is, they don't really have a message. They really don't have a lot of content, but they come up with a lot of activity for the kids, and the kids are very happy. They just aren't learning very much. I teach piano. And years and years ago, lady brought her children to me and said, would you teach my children? This has been a long, long time ago. And I always ask, or usually ask, why are you changing teachers if they're changing? Because depending on the reason tells me something about whether it's going to work or not. You know, if their last teacher was a man and they say, well, you know, we really didn't do well with a man teacher, then coming to me isn't going to help. So I said, you know, why are you changing teachers? And she said, well, my kids really, really enjoy their lessons where they are. They're having a wonderful time, but they're not learning to play the piano. They're just having a lot of fun, but they're not actually learning. She said, I think they're going to grow up to be happy idiots. Happy, but not knowing anything. They had a teacher who was very good at method, but didn't have much of a message, much content. Hendricks says, on the other hand, some teachers are very interested in the message, but their method makes it boring. And he says, we must not clothe the riches of Jesus Christ in rags to make it something that our students do not enjoy. He says, it's a crime to make the Bible boring. The answer to should we focus on the message or the method is we should focus on both. I don't think this thing is going to work for me today. I'm not sure what the problem is. That's okay. You have the handout. So I'll give you an example. Friday, I was teaching a college music history class. Our students had been, the last week, did a musical at the school. And so they've been up late, working hard every night, building the sets, making the costume, and they were exhausted. So this week was a little bit challenging to teach. So on Friday, I was teaching and doing a lecture for music history on Beethoven and how he changes keys in his sonatas, the transitions. Now, to me, it's a fascinating topic. I love to look at this. But as I was teaching, I realized that I was the only one in the room who was interested at all in this topic. You know, I was teaching, and they were just kind of, you know, I would ask a question, and no response. And I was quite honestly rather frustrated with them. You know, I thought, I've prepared, this is a good lecture. You know, I have good content. If you understand this, you're going to know something really good about Beethoven, and you're missing it. And I was just about at the point of just saying, all right, y'all don't want to learn this. Just go home and you'll miss it. And I remembered this. Who is responsible for what the students learn? The teacher. And what's the one thing I can change in the classroom? Myself. I could not get them a good night's sleep the night before. I could not solve all of the difficulties of the week. All I could change was me. So I was teaching and I was going through my content that I thought I had a good message. You know, I had a good bit of content. And all of a sudden I realized, the problem is they don't see any connection whatsoever to their world. You know, this is just too far removed. And as I was teaching, I'm trying to think and pray now, Lord, how can I kind of connect this to them? And all of a sudden hit on something that, this is what they will understand. This is their music and their world. And I pointed to this example. And immediately one of them, I know that. And now they were interested. And by the end of the class, you know, they were discussing and they were arguing about how it ought to be interpreted, the Beethoven example. But it wasn't a problem of the message. It was my method wasn't working. And if you're teaching and the method isn't working, whose fault is it? Yeah, probably the answer is no one's fault. But who has to change? The teacher. Otherwise, the message gets lost. Regardless of how good the message is, if they walk out without connecting with it, we've lost them. Now, today we're going to look, I hope to look at two laws. The first one is the law of application. And these two, part of the reason I felt like we could get through two, even though I only got through one last month, is these two are related. So I'm going to spend more time on the first one, and the second one kind of is a related law. But the law of application says this: the purpose of teaching is to change lives. I think if I did not put that up there and I ask a group, what is the purpose of teaching? I'm afraid that often we would say it's to give information. It is to tell our students something they don't know. And that's part of what we do when we teach. But the purpose of teaching is to change lives. Someone said that knowledge without application brings arrogance. Look at what I know. Paul addresses that in Corinthians when he says, I know you have all knowledge, but, and then he talks about the problems they have. Two examples. One is a bad example. Howard Hendricks tells about a church where he was, and in the Sunday school classes, they gave a prize at the end of the year for the student who had memorized the most Bible verses. And one year, a student had memorized, I believe he said, 600 verses that he was able to quote. Sixth grader, sharp young man, they have on this in the Sunday morning service, they brought this young man up, he quoted some verses, they gave him a trophy. This was someone who knew the Bible. He had it memorized. That's in September. In February or March, one of the Sunday school teachers discovers that someone has been stealing money from the offering. Money is disappearing from the Sunday school offering. And so they begin to check and they begin to investigate. And they find who is the villain. And guess who it is? The boy who had the nice trophy for memorizing Bible verses. They said, Dr. Hendricks said that he brought the young man into his office and he said, you know, you know what the Bible says about stealing? Yes, thou shalt not steal. He could quote several verses. And he said, so why did you steal? And the boy said, I didn't think I would get caught. Did he have knowledge? Yes. Had it changed his life? Absolutely not. The purpose of teaching is not just to give information, but is to change lives. Now, another example that is a positive example. I was teaching a class for teachers in South Africa. Christian school there, and they asked me if I would come and do a class, kind of this material, on for teachers. They're teachers in the school. So I got there a day before the workshop, and I thought, you know, this would be nice. I can just spend a day watching the class before I do my session for the teacher. So I'm sitting in the back of the room, and partway through the day, I see a girl come up to the teacher and whisper to her and says something. And the teacher turns around and says, all right, everyone listen to whatever her name is. Quote, 1 Corinthians 13. The girl stood up and she began to recite 1 Corinthians 13. It wasn't very fluent. It was kind of hesitant. But she got to the end. And when she got to the end, every student in the class jumped to their feet and started cheering. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, I'm glad she did it, but that seems a little bit extreme response. So at break, I said to the teacher, I said, what's the story? She said, we assigned in our class that everyone in the class would memorize 1 Corinthians 13 and quote it in front of the class. And she said, everyone else has gotten it done already. But this girl is very shy, and it's hard for her to do it in front of a class. And also, she doesn't have a sharp memory. And so when she's tried, she said she's gotten up 4 or 5 times to try to do it, and it will get partway through and sit down. And when she got through it today, the class wanted to make her feel wonderful of this achievement. Now, it was good that the class, so everyone in the class, here's what I want you to see. Everyone in the class had memorized 1 Corinthians 13. But what's 1 Corinthians 13 about? Love. More important than memorizing it, it had changed their lives. Because when this student who wasn't very good accomplished it, they all cheered and showed, we love you and we support you. It would have been a much different thing if they had memorized it and then mistreated the student in the class who isn't very smart, who isn't very good in getting in front of people. Somehow that teacher had succeeded not just in getting them to memorize the verses, but in getting them to understand the verses and to apply it to their lives. As teachers, don't settle for, did I get through the material? Did I tell them the information? But did I change their lives? Are they living this out? If I ask you to define learning, and if I have it up here, but you have it on your paper already, so you can read the answer in advance, which is kind of, I shouldn't have done it that way. But the definition that I'm giving you today is learning is change. Because when you have learned something, you are changed. Maybe your thinking is changed, your feelings are changed, your behavior. When you really learn something, something about you changes. Romans 8:29. Let's look at that for a moment, please. Paul is telling us, you know this verse, but Paul is telling us what God's goal for us is. And he says, for those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. God's purpose for us is to be changed, to be conformed to the image of his Son. Now, any of you like Jell-O? You know what Jell-O is? Everybody knows Jell-O? Okay. You can take Jell-O and you can make any kind of a mold. You know, at Christmas, you can put it into Christmas trees. At Easter, you can put it into the shape of a rabbit, whatever. But wherever you pour this Jell-O mix into, what's the shape going to be? Like whatever it is that you've poured it into. Paul says, God is wanting to shape us into the image of his Son. Now, turn to Romans 12. Because Paul gives us this wonderful contrast. Do not be conformed to this world. Do you understand how many times we are like the Jell-O? That is, we are surrounded by this world, we take on the shape of this world, right? I had a student one time. She was a wonderful little high school girl. Very talented, but she always came to her lesson. She was always dressed in all black with all white makeup. She looked, you know, everything was black, and then she was just completely white. And this was back when that was sort of, I think they called it goth. And that was the thing. And so one day she came to her lesson, and she was a wonderful little girl, and I could, you know, ask her questions. She wouldn't get offended. And she came to her lesson one day, and I said, you know, I'm curious about your dress and your outfit. She said, why? I said, why do you dress as you do? And she says, I want to be unique. I want to be special. I said, that's neat. I said, how many of your friends dress like you do? All of them. I said, okay, now I want to get this clear, Adriana. You want to be unique, special, just like all of the other people around you. She said, that doesn't make sense, does it? Does it to me, but maybe it does to you. But what was she doing? She was being shaped by the world around her. Now, she's not the only one. I'm the same. If I'm with a group of people, I want to kind of fit in with them, right? I don't want to stick out. I don't want them, well, you know, he's odd. Paul says, don't let this world, and by this world, he means the way of thinking, the mindset of this world, shape you, push you into its mold. You watch any television commercial, and part of what its message is this. All of the really good people, all of the rich people, all of the admirable, whatever characteristic, this is the car they drive. Do you really want to be without it? The really, really good, you know, people have an iPhone. Do you want to be stuck with something else? Right? What are they doing? The whole idea is to shape me, to push me into a mold. Paul says this, don't let this world squeeze you into its mold, but instead be transformed. And that's the same word over here when he said that God's goal for us is to conform us, to shape us, to transform us into the image of his son. And how is that going to happen? In Romans 12, he says, by the renewing of your mind. That is learning. That is change. Shaping us, transforming us into the image of Jesus Christ. In Taiwan. My family and I lived in Taiwan for 2 years. And there was a girl who started to come to our church. We did an English class, and she started to come to the English class. And we had a Bible study. She started to come to the Bible study. And she was from a very rough background. And she started on Sunday mornings to come to church on Sunday mornings. And she came to me after church one day, and she said, Pastor, I have a question. She said, can you become a Christian by accident? I said, huh? She said, if you don't want to be a Christian, can you become a Christian even though you don't want to be? Well, the answer is no, but I was very curious about the question. And I said, what do you mean? Tell me what you mean. She said, I'm very afraid that I'm becoming a Christian and I don't want to be one. And I said, well, why do you think that? She said, well, you know, my friends, we drink, and she was from a very rough background. You know, she said, we'll go to parties and we will get drunk and this and that. And she said, since I've been coming to this church, some of that I don't enjoy very much. And she said, this week, one of my friends said, Joanne, I think you're becoming a Christian because you don't act like you used to act. And she said, I'm afraid, can I accidentally become a Christian? And I said, Joanne, first of all, the good news from your perspective is no, you can't become accidentally a Christian. But I think I have some bad news for you. She said, what's that? I said, as you see Christians around you, you kind of like it. And you're being drawn to them. And I said, it's good news to me, but from what you're saying, it's bad news for you. What is happening is the Holy Spirit is drawing you. And you are becoming transformed. And I said, the truth is, yes, I think God is going to continue to draw you until you become a Christian. I had the great privilege of baptizing her a few months later. And in her testimony, she said, I didn't want to be a Christian. I just wanted to come learn English. But she said, God began to change my desires. What happened was, Romans 12. She had been conformed to this world, and now God was transforming her, renewing her mind. So teaching is change. It is transforming our students. Our job as teachers is not to impress our students, but to change our students. In graduate school, I had to take a class on acoustics, the physics of music. We had a professor who was very brilliant. I know he was very brilliant, number one, because he had a long list of degrees, and he had a long list of publications, and because the entire semester I never understood a word he said. So I know he had to be very brilliant. But he would walk into the classroom. I can still remember this horrible, horrible semester. He would walk into the class, and he knew the physics of sound and all. He had helped design concert halls and figure out, you know, how to make all the seats the right distance. He knew all the formulas. But he was teaching this class for music majors. And music majors really generally are not very good at formulas. We like to play music or sing or do something, but we're usually not brilliant scientists. Okay, that's an understatement for me. He would walk in, and there was a whiteboard. I don't know. It seems like it was the length of this whole wall up here. But I can remember his teaching, because he would walk in, and he would say, now today I want to talk to you about how to calculate decibels. And he would turn his back, and he would start writing a formula. And he would say, and now you start with this, and you measure this, and you do this, and you do this, and you do this. And he would write, and he would talk as fast as he was writing with his back turned to us. And I'm trying to copy all this down. And when the board was full, he would turn, and he would say, are there any questions? There were never any questions. Because no one in the room understood enough to ask a question. But finally, someone would get up their courage to raise their hand. We were graduate students. We weren't dummies. We'd already been to college. We were working on a master's degree, and we were scared to death of this guy. You know, he had us all scared. Finally, one of us would get up the courage to raise our hand and say, I don't understand. And when they said that, he would get this perplexed look. How could you not understand? And he would say every time, let me explain it again. Erase. The whole thing again. That semester, he impressed us. Okay, I to this day am impressed with how much he knew. He did not change us. At the end of that semester, honestly, I don't think I knew a thing more about acoustics than I did when I walked in the first day. He seemed to settle for impressing his students. And he was good at impressing us. he wasn't good at connecting where we were to where he was. He couldn't come down and say, now, here's where you are. Let me move you forward. Teaching that changes lives doesn't simply go from head to head, but it goes from heart to heart. Deuteronomy 6, verse 6 says, the commandments that I give you today are to be where? On your hearts. Now in the Bible, the heart is not just a physical organ. It's not, you know, this thing that's pumping. It's not just emotion. We often today use the heart that way. You know, the kids, I heart you. It's an emotion. I love you, and tomorrow I may not. You know, tomorrow I may heart someone else. It's just emotion. In the Bible, the heart is the totality. Your mind, your will, your emotion. It's the whole person is the heart. It's not just mental knowledge. It's not do as I say, not as I do. It is, he's saying, the commandments that I give you today are to be where? All through you. Your heart is the totality of who you are. And so that means, will you know those commandments? Yes, they will be in your mind. Will you be committed to those commandments? Yes, they'll be in your will. Will you love those commandments? Yes, they'll be in your emotions. Will you obey those commandments? Yes, they'll be in your hands, in your actions. What Moses is saying is, I want these commandments to envelop you and change how you live. That's what it means to touch hearts. Jesus said, I am the way, truth, the life. Not, I teach the truth, but I am the truth. Someone said to me that had read on different religions, if there was no Buddha, the message of Buddhism wouldn't change. But if there was no Christ, there would be no message. You see, they said, Buddha said, you're not following me, you are following the way. And this is the teaching that I give you. Without me, the teaching is the same. But Christ says, I am the way. I am the truth. Not I teach it to you, but I am it. If you're going to impact your students, it's not enough to impress them. You have to change them. And that means you have to reach beyond the knowledge to the heart. I was, as a principal, observing a choir director leading a rehearsal. And she started the rehearsal with these words. The main thing in the music we're singing today is the message. And I want you to get the message across to those we're singing to. And then for 45 minutes, they rehearsed without ever again going back to the message of the songs they were singing. And the kids, I could see on their faces, they were just saying blah, 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 blah. And when we met afterwards, I said to the teacher, you know, you lied to your students at the beginning of the rehearsal, and that's not going to go very well with them. What do you mean? I said, you told them the main thing is what? The message. But nothing after that was ever about the message. You knew in your head what to say, but it didn't come to the heart of transforming the students. Hearts touch hearts. You see, your character is what produces confidence in the learner. The student knows he can trust you because of your character. And if you lose the student's confidence because they see a flaw in their teacher's character, it's very hard to get it back. I won't ask for a show of hands, but have you ever lost your temper with your students? If you do, if you show a weakness of character in losing your temper with the students, it is very hard to regain their confidence. As teachers, one of the hardest things we have to learn is at times to say, "I'm sorry, I failed." Because you see, I don't like to do that. I don't want to go to a student and say, "I was wrong, I'm sorry." But if they see in my character a failure, and I refuse to deal with it, I've destroyed their confidence in me as a teacher, in my character, and I'm not going to get through to their heart. They may still listen to the words, but I'm not going to touch their heart. It is the teacher's compassion that produces motivation in the student. You see, if the student knows you really love them, they'll work hard to please you, right? When they know you really care about them, they'll work hard. The disciples, you know, when we read the Gospels, I think sometimes we forget that following Jesus, being a disciple of Jesus, wasn't a very easy life. James, John, what was their job before they followed Jesus? Fishermen. Now, that's not an easy way to make a living, but they were sort of they were up here. They owned the boats. Their family was a little bit uppity. When they followed Jesus, they're at the bottom. You know, they're going to have a rough life. Why are they willing to put up with it? Why are they faithful to him? Partly because they know he loves them. He was pouring his life into them. And so they wanted to please him. Your students need to know you care about them. You love them. You're interested in them. You've got to be interested in what matters to them. One of my piano students, I don't teach very many children, but I have just a few children that I teach because I don't want to get separated as a college teacher. You know, I don't want to just be talking about teaching and not actually doing it. So I try to always have a few young students that I teach. And I have a girl who... She isn't really very interested in piano. She's taking because her mom wants her to take. Her mom's a single mom and is looking for a way to give her daughter some activity. And so, and I enjoy teaching her because it's a challenge. Since she's just not naturally interested, it's a good challenge to find how to work with her. So she came to her lesson a few months ago, and I am not very good at number two here, compassion, of showing compassion. I'm not good at connecting with, I want to get done. Here's what we're here for. Let's do it. So she walks in, and as I usually do, all right, let's play your first piece. But at my piano, someone had put, before I moved into the office, there's a mirror right next to the piano. And she sits down and starts, and I see her looking in the mirror. And I said, "Sabrina, let's get to work." And I get her started. And we start, and pretty soon I see her looking in the mirror again. I said, "Sabrina, pay attention. Look at this. So we start again. And all of a sudden it struck me. I said, "Sabrina, do you have a new dress on?" yeah. I said, that is really a pretty dress. We were fine. From there on, we had a good lesson. But there was no getting to what was important to me until first I knew what? That she had a new dress, and this new dress was important to her, and so it had better be important to me. Your compassion, your interest in the students is going to motivate them to want to please you, to work hard. As Sunday school teachers, our interest is the content a lot of times. Look at what we need to get through. And yet sometimes taking the time to be interested in the little thing that they're interested in first is going to get us a long ways down the road towards getting the content that we want to do. But if we ignore their concerns in order to get to our content, we probably won't get through to them. We've got to start with their interest. Once we have earned their trust with our character, with our compassion, then the content produces the understanding. Once they know this teacher is interested in me, this teacher hears me, now they're ready to listen and get understanding. But until then, we're just giving them information. We are, as you all very well know, in the middle of a political season in which all the candidates are yelling at us their ideas. How many of you think that they probably are very, very concerned about what you or I think and would like to see? Is there anyone who listens to the candidates and thinks, they're really concerned about me? They have my best interests at heart. I want to see if there's anyone gullible in the room. No. And so doesn't that make it kind of hard for us to hear them? Because we know they really don't care. They just want elected. And yet, think about what it would do to you, what it would do to me, if a candidate, a politician, sat down and genuinely was interested in what we had to say. Wouldn't that make us a whole lot more open to what they say? You know, the fact is we need someone to hear us before we're ready to listen to them. And our students need us to listen to them before they're ready to hear. And so they have to see our character, our compassion, and then they're ready to listen to our content. If we want to touch their hearts, we have to know three things. We have to know our students. Some of you teach kindergarten, right? Who you teach kindergarten? Yeah, I mixed you. Okay, all right. Yes, is pardon? You're teaching pre-kindergarten? Okay. For us as adults, our children's world is quite different than our world, right? You know, what a kindergarten student or certainly a pre-kindergarten student is interested in is a whole lot different than what we're interested in as adults. And yet somehow we have to know their world. I got an email from a student a few weeks ago. I don't know if I told you this or not. I got a student question from a student, an email. And they asked me a question, Justin Bieber. How many of you know who Justin Bieber is? Okay, a few of you do. Most of you are like me. You're old and you don't know who Justin Bieber is. But Justin Bieber had said something, and my student wanted to know what I thought about it. And so he emails me, what do you think about what Justin Bieber said about Christians? And I emailed back, who is Justin Bieber? And he comes to my office. He'd been over in the library. He sends me this email. He comes across campus and he comes to my office and he says, you don't know who Justin Bieber is? I said, No. Should I want to know who Justin Bieber is? And he looks at me and he says, well, probably not. Well, then I was curious. So I go online and I start, you know, first I even misspelled it, you know, B-E-E-B-E-R. But Justin Bieber is well known enough that if you Google Justin B-E-E-B-E-R, it will fix it for you. That's how popular he is. And I start to read, and I read, and I read. And when I'm done, I call my student. I said, does it matter what he said? But here was the thing. I then had a good conversation with my student. But here was the thing. As I read and talked to my student, I realized I don't know the world of my students. Because this Justin Bieber person is very popular. I went to class a day later, my freshman Bible class, and I told them about this. And the class was amazed that I didn't know who Justin Bieber was. And I realized, you know, if I don't know their world, it may be hard for me to take this timeless word and apply it to their world. Because I'll just be in my own little world here with this book. Years and years ago, Karl Barth said, as preachers, and this would be true for teachers, we must teach, he said, with the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other. His point was this. This word, he wasn't saying that we interpret this based on the newspaper. He was saying this word applies to our world in every day. And we must look at what is happening in our world and then say, see, what does this say to our world? But to do that, we have to know the world of our students. We must know our students. We must know our subject. Earn the right to be heard by knowing your subject. And I'm assuming here that you know the subjects you're teaching, and I'm not going to spend time there. But the third, know yourself. Be vulnerable before your students. As teachers, it's very easy for us to be like the professor of acoustics that I told you about, who is an expert, and we have this facade. And we never open ourselves to our students. I was observing the teachers in the academy one year. And the teacher was doing a math lesson. And as she was writing on the board and doing the math problem, she made a mistake. It was just a simple mistake, but it messed up the, you know, answer. And when she got done, the answer was not what it should have been because she had made a mistake in doing the math. And I saw that she had made the mistake, and I was very interested to see what was going to happen. Because, you see, some teachers would never be able to say, oh, I was wrong. And so they would just try to pass it off, maybe say, oh, I did that to see if you would catch it. Okay, or erase it real fast and just go on. This teacher came to the end, she looked at it, and she said, that answer's not right. I did something wrong. And one of the students said, back in step 3, you multiplied wrong. Ah, I did. Thank you. And she fixed it and she went on. End of the day, it's time for our conference. She came in very embarrassed and apologetic and said, oh, I hope I don't get fired. I said, this was the best teaching I have seen all day. Because you made a mistake. And everyone in the room knew that you had made a mistake. You know, it was an obvious math error. Had you tried to cover it up, they would not respect you. in the future. But instead, you said, I was wrong. Let's fix it. Now, if you don't know your subject, point two, if you're constantly making mistakes, at some point that's going to become a problem. Okay? But as a teacher, if you make a mistake, it's okay. Be honest. Be open with your students. My daughter teaches third grade. And a few weeks ago, she was laughing. She was at the grocery getting groceries. And she said she saw one of her little third graders come around the corner and see her. Froze. Went running back to her mom and says to her mom, and Stacy can hear her on the next aisle, Mom, Mrs. Statler buys groceries. Yeah. You know, the kid thought that her teacher probably lives in the classroom and they just bring in, you know, on some kind of a pod, her food, and they feed her there at her desk. She didn't know that, you know, teachers go to the grocery, they do all of this stuff. My teacher buys groceries. But, you know, your students sometimes don't think you're real. You know that? They think that you're some kind of a artificial person. In Sunday school, they think you're a saint. Okay? You teach youth. Right? Yeah. Yeah. They don't think you've ever been tempted. Now, they have these temptations. They struggle with these emotions and these temptations and tests. But not our teacher. He was born as a saint. And when he was a teenager, he just glided through life. Right? Do you understand what a wonderful blessing it is to a student to learn? My teacher struggled with this. My teacher had this temptation. Sometimes just to know my teacher failed in this area is incredibly powerful because it makes us real. They understand that we're not just giving them information, but this is an area that we struggled with. This is an area where we failed, and yet God was able to transform us into His image. Know your students, know your subject, know yourself. If we're going to transform our students' lives with our teaching, we have to know them. We have to know ourselves. And then if we're going to transform them, there has to be meaningful activity. Howard Hendricks said, if teaching were only about telling, our students would be brilliant because we tell them all the time. Information, information, information. Teaching is more than telling. Teaching is getting them involved meaningfully in the activity. It means involving every student, not allowing students to disappear in the classroom. Now, all of us have this problem. I'm assuming all of us have this problem. I have this problem. I teach a freshman Bible class. And it is a struggle for me. And here is why. In the freshman Bible class, there are about 4 students who every question I ask, they can answer. And they want to answer. There are a couple students who are fascinated by the Bible. And they want to discuss and they want to argue and they want to talk. And I would be very happy to say to the other 26 students, go home, because we have some serious stuff to talk about here. And these 4, we would just sit and we would discuss and we would get a lot done. And then I have out of this 30, you know, there's 4 or 5 that are fascinated and ready to go. And then there is in the middle a group of probably 20 who are there They're not terribly fascinated by the topic, but they're not opposed to the topic. I have to work to get them involved, but it's possible. And then there will always be, it seems the Lord always includes a few, three or four, whose attitude is, I dare you to teach me something. I came to this college because it's close to the ocean. And I dare you to teach me something. See if it can be done. As a teacher, one of the challenges is to involve every student, including those who really don't want to be involved. Bruce Wilkinson is a graduate from Dallas Seminary, and he writes about being in Howard Hendricks' class. Howard Hendricks is dead now, but he was just a master teacher. And Bruce Wilkinson said that in his class, Hendricks had the ability to connect with every student. He would pull the student into the class. Bruce Wilkinson said one semester he decided, I want to see if I can disrupt this. I want to see what will happen. And so he says he went to class one day, and Dr. Hendricks started teaching, and Wilkinson said, I looked out the window. And he says, Dr. Hendricks was teaching, and he said, I just stared out the window. And he said, in a few minutes, Dr. Hendricks told a joke. Now, he said, Dr. Hendricks would always tell a joke about 30 minutes into the class, because that's about the time the people were going to start to drift. But he said this time he moved the joke up to 5 minutes into the class. And he said, I didn't even crack a smile. He said, it was a good joke, but I wanted to see what would happen.
More jokes.
So he said, Hendricks told another joke. He said, Hendricks said something that he knew would cause an argument in the class. Finally, he said, Dr. Hendricks came back and got right in front. Wilkinson, what's wrong with you this morning? He said, he could not tolerate a student not being involved in the class. I read that, and I was very convicted, because you see, I realize that as a teacher, I am very often tempted to teach who? The ones who want to learn. And if you don't want to learn, tough luck. You'll just go away as dumb as when you came in, and it's your own fault. You see, there's a problem with that. The ones who wanted to learn were going to learn even if I wasn't there, because they want to learn. And if I'm not there, they'll go to the library and find it. They'll go to Google and find it. They'll learn it with or without me. Okay? When my four students who are fascinated by freshman Bible, they want to understand Romans, and so they're going to ask questions. When I start to talk to them, I can feel like, wow, you know, I'm really a good teacher. We had some good discussion today. Probably teacher of the year. But you know the truth? I didn't do a thing. Because those four guys were going to learn it anyway. They want to know. The test for the teacher, if I'm going to be teacher of the year, it's not those four. It's, can I find a way to connect Romans to these who don't see that Romans has anything to do with them at all? And they're just there because this is the class I was assigned to. That's the test of my teaching. And so as a teacher, I must find, how do I connect this with the students? How do I involve them? Because maximum involvement brings maximum learning. You see, let's say that you decided you wanted to learn about the Holy Land. Anybody here been to Israel? Okay, so maybe you say, next month when you come, I'd like to learn about the Holy Land. Let's do a class about the Holy Land. Now, I could give you a lecture on it. I've been there. I've read a bunch of books about it. I could prepare a 55-minute lecture on the Holy Land and come in and give you 55 minutes of information. I could tell you what I've seen as far as how it's divided between the Arabs and Israelis. I could, give you a lot of information. Of that 55 minutes, how much would you remember? Not very much. Maybe the equivalent of 5 minutes of it you would remember when you left. I could come back. You see, when I was there, I took a lot of pictures. And so I could have pictures. I could show you a picture that I took of the empty tomb. I could show you a little video clip that I took as we went across the Sea of Galilee. I could show you where the mountain is next to the sea, where he did the Sermon on the Mount. I could give you pictures. Then how much of it would you remember? You'd do quite a lot better, wouldn't you? You would connect the pictures with the, and you'd do much better. But I have a friend who organizes trips to the Holy Land. And if we could get a group of 20 from this church to go to the Holy Land, we'd walk through the Garden Tomb. We would take a boat across the Sea of Galilee. And as we're going across, we can talk about the storm that came and all. When you came back, how much would you know about the Holy Land? A lot more, because now you would have been there, you would have walked, you would have seen, there's a wonderful museum that has a boat that was, they dug up from the time of Jesus that was preserved underground. All of this stuff you would have seen, you would have touched, you would have been a part of. Now you would remember it. Okay? The more you're involved, the more you learn. So let's do a trip to the Holy Land. That's side advertisement. Here's what they say. I hear and I forget. I see and I remember. I do and I understand. Psychologists say you may remember up to 10% of what you hear. Now, most people won't. That you're really good if you remember 10%. You're probably a genius. But that's kind of the maximum. You may remember 50% if you see it and hear it. But you may remember up to 90% of what you see, hear, and do. But more importantly, if I keep doing, I change. That becomes who I am. I am transformed. Jesus gives us an example. Turn to Mark 6. Mark 6, verse 30 tells us the story of the feeding of the 5,000. Now, if Jesus wanted to teach the disciples the secret to ministering to others is to allow me, Jesus, to work through you and what you have. If Jesus gave a 50-minute lecture on trusting Jesus to meet your needs and trusting him to multiply your provisions, how much would they learn? They would learn some of it. But when they come to him and they say, we can't feed these people. We don't have enough. And he says, well, bring me what you have. And he starts to break it. Do you think they ever forgot that lesson? How many of you think that they remembered that lesson from then on? Yeah? Sort of. We'll come back to it here in a minute. That miracle, by the way, is the only miracle that's in all four Gospels. I have often wondered why that. I mean, there are other miracles that to me are more impressive than that one. Raising Lazarus is more impressive. I think one reason it's in all four Gospels, they did it. They were involved. This stuck with them because they were involved in the activity. But there's something else about this activity. You see, many times, how many of you have taught something? The students didn't learn it, and you said, well, let's go on to the next lesson. Anybody ever done that other than me? Yeah, I'm afraid I've done it. You know, they're not going to get this one, so let's go on. Jesus is a much better teacher than I am. And so here's what happens. You see, they do the lesson. They kind of learn it. But go to chapter 8 of Mark. A great crowd had gathered. They had nothing to eat. Called his disciples to him and said, have compassion on the crowd. They've been with me 3 days, have nothing to eat. And his disciples said, Jesus, this is no problem. We know what you can do. Let's just find a little bit of bread and you'll feed them, right? No, what did the disciples say? Send them home. Why? We don't have enough food. And Jesus, it would seem to me, could have said, God, you gave me the dumbest disciples in the world. 2 chapters ago, I fed 5,000. Go back to Mark 6, verse 52. They did not understand about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. I hear, I forget. I see, I understand, remember. I do, I understand. However, it's not until I keep doing that I change. Teachers, of all the qualities that are important to you, perhaps the most important one is patience, to teach and to teach and to keep teaching. John Wesley's mother named Susanna. There were 19 children in the family. And she taught them all at home until they were old enough to send away. And at the age, I believe it was of 5, she would set them down and start them learning to read. Her husband one day watched her teaching a lesson. And when it was done, he said, I don't know how you do it. You taught the same thing 23 times before they finally understood it. And she looked at her husband and said, if I had only taught it 22 times, all my efforts would have been wasted. Because they didn't get it until the 23rd time. I remember that sometimes when I'm ready to say to a student, well, just forget that, let's go on. If you just forget it and go on, you wasted all your efforts because they didn't get it. I must keep my students doing until they change. Jesus is willing to teach this lesson, get them involved, over and over until they finally understand. Now, what I'm saying to you is the law of activity. I must have them involved. The application, I must have them involved in order to learn it. But it's not enough just to have activity. It must be meaningful activity. True or false? And I, again, I have, you have the answers there. That's unfortunate. Is it true that practice makes perfect? How many say true? How many say false? I have to go with the false on this. Because if you practice it wrong, it will be permanently wrong. Right? The truth is, practice makes permanent. You see, I don't play golf. But you go down to play golf and you hit the ball. My dad, for a while, he said, let's learn something about golf. Now, he and I were both tightwads, and so we would never pay whatever it cost to go to the golf course. But we would go to the driving range because you can hit a whole bunch of balls for just a little bit of money. It was a very waste of time. Because, you see, my dad and I, neither one of us knew a thing about golf. But we would get a bucket of balls. And we would hit the ball, and it would go over there. Hit the ball, and it would go over here. Hit the ball, and it would go back behind us. Yes, it was good exercise, ducking, dodging. Practice. For a year, my dad and I practiced almost once a week. And it never made perfect. In fact, it really didn't even make us any better. Why? We never did one important thing, and that is get someone who knew something about golf to watch us and tell us what we were doing wrong. If we had done that, then the practice could have helped. But instead, we just did it. Practicing golf doesn't improve your game unless a coach tells you what is you're doing wrong. Too many teachers settle for activity without evaluating and improving what is going on. Our brother here, you're a tutor, right? You see, tutors have a great opportunity and a great responsibility because when you're working with a tutor, I'm assuming one-on-one or a small group? Okay. So you have the opportunity to see them do it, to see what is wrong, to help them change it, and to improve. That is practice that will make a difference, right? Too many times students do it, they do it wrong, and what do? We go to the next lesson. Did they improve it? No. They practiced it, but it didn't change. What about this statement? Experience is the best teacher. True? Now you're afraid to answer. How many would say, yes, experience is the best teacher? How many would say, I think there's a trick somewhere? Evaluated, guided experience is the best teacher. You see, experience by itself doesn't improve us unless someone is helping us to know, what did I do wrong? We often say, we learn by doing. That may be true, but we really learn by doing the right things. You see, experience itself isn't enough. You don't want your students to learn the dangers of cocaine through experience, do you? You want them to learn a different way. And so my point is, what kind of activity do we give our students? Because, especially in Sunday school, it seems to me that we can get by with just giving them stuff to do. Busy work, activity that doesn't really accomplish our goal of application. The kind of activities we need are activities that provide direction, but not dictatorship. In other words, that gives them freedom to learn It gives them instruction. It gives them direction. But it's not a straitjacket that this is the only way to do it. It gives them some freedom to learn. It's activity that has a clear purpose. It's not just busy work. How many of you have been either in a classroom or in a Sunday school where the teacher gave you something to do and you were pretty sure there was no purpose to it whatsoever other than filling up time? Anybody ever had any of those assignments? And how frustrating is it? Very. How much do you learn? Not a lot. Our activity needs to be activity that has clear purpose and guides them to learning. You see, it seems to me that for a lot of teachers, the name of the game is just fill up the paper, do the activity, fill up the time, rather than teaching the students something that has a clear purpose and that will guide them. Let me give you an example. Luke chapter 10 is the story of the Good Samaritan. You all know that story, right? If that is your Sunday school lesson, how do we usually teach it? What would you normally do for teaching the story of the Good Samaritan? I'm not going to say you're wrong, so you're just free to say whatever you would do. What do you normally do for the story of the Good Samaritan? And I'm going to leave out the pre-K because they can't read the story, and what I'm going to talk about, they have to read it, okay? But what would we normally do to teach the story of the Good Samaritan? Who's the good guy? Okay. How are we going to do that? Okay. So you're going to have the students do it, right? Okay, everybody, is that how you would do it? Let me ask you a question and be honest here for a minute, even though it hurts. How many of you would generally do this by simply telling them the story from the Bible and saying at the end, now, here is why the Samaritan was the good person in this story? Anybody would normally teach it that way? I have to be honest, I would. That's just the easiest way to do it, isn't it? Doesn't that save you a lot of time? You tell them the story and you say, here's the good guy and here's why they're good. Go home and be like the Samaritan. Sorry, but that's generally the way I would do it because that's the quickest and easiest. What if, number one, as our sister says, what if I let them figure out who's the good guy and why? Will they learn something more that way? They've actually had to think. They've had to enter into the story and figure it out. But what if I do this? And again, this is assuming they can read. So I'm moving up, you know, at least to your kids should be able to do this. What if I teach them how to study a story, a parable? What if I tell them, what are the questions you need to answer to be able to understand a parable? Okay, I need some background. I need to know in that story who is a priest, what a Levite is, why they don't like Samaritans, right? How are students going to find that? By asking the teacher, right? In which case, when you're not there, how much can they do? None. So let's throw out that answer for a moment. How could a student in a Sunday school class find out who Samaritans are and who Levites are? Remember, I'm wanting them to get meaningful activity, not just listen to me. How can they do that? Okay, now they can check online. All right. How many of your students probably could do that right from the classroom while you're teaching? Yeah? A Bible dictionary? If I have a Bible dictionary in my classroom, which if you're going to teach Sunday school, if they're able to read, you need one in there. Because they can look it up. Now, They are then learning how to make sense of the story, right? Why he told it. Almost every time Jesus tells a parable, he tells it because someone asked a question. And if I'm going to understand a parable, I think I told you this once when we were looking at Gospels together. If I'm going to understand a parable, what do I have to know? What question was Jesus answering? Because if I don't know what question he was answering, I may come up with a completely different message from this parable. What is the question that Jesus is answering when he tells the parable of the Good Samaritan? Yeah, okay. He's, what do I have to do to be saved? Love God, love your neighbor. Who is my neighbor? And he tells them the story. I want my students to understand this question and how to hear the parable. Then I want them to ask, what's the lesson? Luke 10, look at it. Luke 10. Am I the one that's making that racket? Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? He said, the one who showed him mercy. Jesus said, go and do likewise. What is the lesson? The one who actively meets the needs of others is the one who is a neighbor who shows love, right? And then I want the students to apply this. What could, and this can be at any age, what can your kindergarten students do, your elementary students do to apply this lesson? They have classmates who are not popular. They're the ones that can show love to that person who's not popular, to help someone who has a need. Now, if instead of giving a lecture on Luke 10 and the Good Samaritan, I help the students to work through that lesson and understand how to find information about the story, how to figure out the story, then I'm ready to give them some homework that is meaningful. Homework like this. Read Luke 15, the story of the prodigal son, and figure out the same questions, the same answers that I did in class with the Good Samaritan. You see, that way, they now have some tools. They can go to the story of the prodigal son, and they can look up some background to find out why does a younger brother and an elder brother, why do they get treated differently? That's in that same dictionary that has about the Samaritan. They can find out what is the question that was asked, what caused Jesus to tell this story. The beginning of the chapter, it says that Jesus is eating with sinners and the Pharisees are criticizing him for eating with sinners. And so he tells a story to show why heaven rejoices when a prodigal comes home. Then I've given them tools. You understand, my activity has given them tools that they will be able to study the Bible themselves and find answers. Activity needs to have a clear purpose. It's not just busy work. But if my students do this activity, what will I have accomplished? It must be activity that provides application. Something in their life that they're going to apply. Look at your Sunday school curriculum. I don't know your curriculum. I hope it's a wonderful one. A lot of curriculum for Sunday schools has almost no application for our students. It's made up of questions like this. Where was Jesus born? And it sometimes will even give them in parentheses. The answer is in verse 17, so that they won't have to, you know, read a whole chapter to find the answer. Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea. Please write that on your papers. Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea. And that's all fine information. But if the purpose of teaching is to change lives, there has to be more than that. There has to be activity that provides application. What in this Sunday school lesson would transform their lives if they actually lived it out? If your students left here and lived like the Good Samaritan, would that change their witness in the schools they go to? Absolutely. If your students left here and understood the message of the prodigal son, would that change their relationship with the people around them? Absolutely. As they understood how desperately heaven rejoices, how much heaven rejoices when a lost soul comes home. Those things need to be application in their lives. Activity that teaches the process, how to learn, and that's what we were looking at how you look it up. And then activity that is realistic. That means, what are their problems, and how do I apply the Bible to them? I have thought for several years asking this question. Why is it that so many of our young people, when they reach 18, abandon the church? Now, I don't know your church. I don't know your demographic. But nationwide, the majority of young people who grow up in the church, who are in church from year one through high school, when they go away to college, the majority within a year have abandoned the church. Are you aware of that? And that's tragic, because it means we are failing somehow to build into our youth a love for God. Part of it, I'm convinced, is we fail to be realistic in our teaching of our kids. We fail to be realistic in recognizing the fact that their problems are genuine. We give them a picture of the Christian life that is not realistic. I want to be careful, but I want you to understand this. I've heard revival sermons that do something like this for young people. Young people, if you obey God and you live your life for God, your life is going to be full and rich and beautiful and wonderful. Or you can live your life for the devil and waste your life, and it will be a tragedy and your life will be ruined. How many of you would rather live for God, and how many of you would rather live for the devil? Now, that sounds all good and well, and everyone raises their hand on living for God, right? I don't want to disillusion you, but there are a whole lot of people who live for God whose lives are incredibly difficult, right? I had a young man who came to me. And he said, I was living for the devil. And it was fun. He said, I was on a soccer scholarship in a university. I could have any girl I wanted. Parties, a great time. And he said, I'll tell you why I left the church. I found out they lied to me. They said I wasn't going to have any fun. And it was fun. Now, he said, I came to the realization finally, but wait a minute, the end of that road wasn't where I wanted to go. But he said somewhere along the line, I needed a youth leader, a Sunday school teacher, to realize that the reality of temptation is it's appealing. It's fun. And to give me tools to face that temptation realistically. You understand? Not simply to paint it as terrible and hope I never found out that actually there was a whole lot of fun involved. But to help me to understand the end result and to understand that the fun doesn't last. And more than that, to give me the tools to face that temptation and to answer it. We have to give our students at every level activity that is realistic, that prepares them, that builds in them the strength to live out Scripture and to apply it in their world. And I think that has to start from the beginning. Now, do you teach kindergartners different than you teach high school students? Yeah, you better. Okay. But at kindergarten, helping to build in students the ability to take Scripture and learn it and apply it and to live it out. And that works all the way through so that by the time our students are going out to the university, they have built in them the character and the commitment to Christ to prepare them for the challenges they'll face, rather than simply a set of verses they've memorized, but they've never actually lived them out and fed them into their heart. The law of application says, if I want to change my students, I've got to give them a way to apply the Scripture to their lives in a realistic way that meets their needs. Is that going to require sometimes us to admit to our students we don't have all the answers? Yeah. Our brother here, you work with the young people. I both envy and pity you. Envy in that you have an incredible opportunity. Pity in that our young people today have incredible challenges. We who are old don't understand, I think, all of the pressures that our young people face. And if we do not give them the tools to face those pressures, we are setting them up for when they graduate from high school to walk out of the church and never come back because they don't have the answers to the challenges and the difficulties of their life today. Give activity that is preparing them to take God's word and to apply it in life. Now, I told you the third law I'm not going to say very much about because it's very closely related, but the law of retention says we retain facts only when we understand them. I already told you, I am not good at science. Science to me doesn't make sense. Music makes sense to me. Now, if you come to me and you tell me some musical fact that I didn't know, something about a composer that I didn't know, something about music, I'll hear you, I'll understand it, and I'll probably remember it. I'll go away and I'll know something and understand something I did. You can come and you could tell me something about science, and I'll nod and I'll smile at you and I'll say, that's very interesting. And when I get out that door, if you gave me a true and false question test about it, I'd miss it. Why? I have no understanding. I have no framework for adding this bit of new information. Okay? When we understand facts, we remember them. When it's just things to memorize, we don't retain them. And the best way of understanding is as the student discovers not what I'm telling them, but as I guide them to discover and learn. The more we are involved in our own learning, the more we learn. Again, back to our brother who is a tutor. Part of why tutors succeed is by working one-on-one, you're able to guide that student to finding an answer, whereas in a big class, the tendency is to pour out a bunch of information and not to give them that opportunity to find for themselves. As teachers, as a general rule, don't tell students what they can learn for themselves. Let them find it for themselves. Let them learn it for themselves. Back to our parable of the Good Samaritan. Which is the student more likely to remember? If you tell them the story, and you tell them that the Good Samaritan was the good one, and here is why, or if they take that story and they figure out the difference between them, and they figure out why the priest wants to hurry on, and maybe we help them to find out that, did you know there is a good reason for that priest to go on, right? Everybody knows that. Because if he touches this person and the person dies, he's unclean. He can't do his duties as a priest. Would you agree that that's a pretty good excuse not to stop? I mean, does that make sense to you? I can think that there would be a group of students who would be able to argue very well that, yeah, he had a good reason not to stop, right? If I let the students understand the danger in this territory, if I can show them a picture and show them how it was a very dangerous road, there's a good reason for that Levite not to stop, because he might get robbed. If you are teaching the parable of the Good Samaritan, drive through, I don't know, downtown Miami, late at night, on your way to teach that parable, and you'll do a much better job of understanding the poor Levite. Because if I'm driving down through Miami, downtown Miami, late at night, and someone says stop, the Levite is going to be my model as I carry on, right? There's good reason. Now, if I allow them to do that and discover for themselves the excuses, the good reasons, now, will they have a better appreciation for the Good Samaritan? Will they have a better understanding of how much it's likely to cost if I live according to the Samaritan rather than the priest and the Levite? Because, again, our teaching needs to be realistic. And a lot of times when I hear the Good Samaritan story, it's just too easy to be the Samaritan, because the priest is such a bad guy in how we tell it. The Levite is such a bad guy in how we tell it that everyone knows, yes, of course, I'm going to be the Samaritan. But the truth is, that Samaritan's position is pretty hard. And in real life, it's not so black and white and easy. I may have told you I was going somewhere and I had been asked to talk about the story of the Good Samaritan. That was going to be my message. And as I was driving there, someone tried to flag me down because their car had broken down. I don't know anything about cars. And I said, I can't stop. Number one, I couldn't help them. And number two, I'm going to be late to where I'm speaking. And so I went on. I got there, and I open up my notes, and I think, wait a minute. I'm the priest in this story. I just drove by this guy on my way to teach the story of what? The Good Samaritan. But I had a very good excuse. So did the priest. So did the Levite. But the Samaritan wasn't looking for a very good excuse. He was asking, how do I help a person in need? Help our students to learn for themselves. You see, as teachers, we are not the player in the football game. We are the coach. The coach doesn't say to these guys, now let me run the next play. I know how this ought to be done, so let me do it. Give me the football and I'll run it. The coach says, you're the guys that are going to run this play. Let me inspire you. Let me encourage you. Let me guide you, and you'll do it. Education is not primarily about what I do, but what the student does. Good teachers are not focused primarily on how well did I teach the lesson, but on how well do my students apply the lesson. I teach piano. Students come to the college. They pay money to learn to play the piano. Little kids come. Their parents pay me to teach them. Imagine that in May we have a recital. In fact, here I have his children in piano. So we come to the end of the semester, and I announce we're going to have a recital in May. They get there. The students are all here on the front row lined up that have been my students all year. And I get up and I say to the parents in the audience, I am the teacher. I am the best pianist in this room. And so I will be playing the pieces tonight. And the students will sit here and listen. Are the parents going to be very happy with that solution? No. What are they paying me for? To teach their kids to play. Now, I don't think I'm proud if I say I can probably play those pieces better than the students, at least most of them. Right? But they're not paying me to play them. They're paying me to teach their children to play them. As teachers, our role is not doing it. It is inspiring the children that we teach to do it. We are the ones to motivate, to inspire, to guide them. Someone said there are four steps in learning. Early on, you don't know that you don't know something. Again, let me do this from piano students. A piano student comes into their first lesson. They don't even know what they don't know about playing the piano, right? They don't know where middle C is. They don't even know they don't know where middle C is because they don't know there is a middle C, right? Maslow called this unconscious incompetence. You don't know what you don't know. Then he said we move from that to what he called conscious incompetence. And that is, I know I don't know it. We start to have some lessons. We start to learn the notes on the piano. And at some point, a student might say, what is the bottom note on the piano? What has happened? You see, we've moved up a notch. We've gone from not knowing what they don't know to knowing that I don't know what that note is. That's progress. He said that we then move to conscious competence. That is the day when they say, Mom, I know the name of every key on the piano. A, B, C, and I can go all the way through. I know them all. I know it. Maslow said the goal of education is what he called unconscious competence. That is, we just know it to the point where we don't even know we know it anymore. It's just part of us. For piano, the example is this Horowitz was a great, great pianist. And after a concert, some little kid came up to him and said, "Mr. Horowitz, how many keys are on the piano?" He didn't know. He knew so much. He played so well that that was just something that he no longer knew if he knew it or not. It just didn't matter anymore. Okay? Now, here's the problem for us as teachers. The subjects that we teach, if we really know them, where are we on this? We're on number four, right? We don't even think about knowing it anymore. It's just who we are. And where are our students? They don't even know they don't know it yet, right? And we can miss them. We can be not addressing their needs. Our goal as teachers is to move them from here to here. And we do that by guiding them, not by telling them stuff, but guiding them to find it. And so, we don't do for a student what they are capable of doing for themselves. I have sometimes said to the students who are going to be teachers at the college, when you become a teacher, make sure you never work harder than your students. In other words, don't you do it all, but you guide them to do it. Otherwise, you make them educationally disabled. People who have to be pushed around in a wheelchair. How many of you have students who never learn anything unless someone feeds it to them? Understand? They are educationally disabled. They have to be fed everything. They have to be pushed everywhere. You can say, well, they're lazy, they're this, that. But the truth is, somewhere along the line, someone failed to teach them how to learn it. One of the best piano teachers I ever had was a teacher who never, ever, I can't remember him ever telling me anything. His approach to teaching was purely this: if you want to know, ask. Now, understand, the maturity of your student matters. Okay, this was a teacher of advanced students. But if you went in and with no questions, you paid him $200 for an hour and you just wasted your $200 because he never told you anything unless you ask. He had intuitively come to find that for him, teaching the students he taught, the way to do it is he had to find out what did you want to know, and then he could help you. Now, again, the maturity of your students will matter. But here's what I'm wanting you to see. Have you heard this statement? I've given you several true and false. Have you heard this statement? You can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. How many of you have heard this? How many of you would agree that is true? I'm going to say it's false. There is a very simple way to make the horse drink. It is not, as some teachers will do, holding the horse's head under the water until he finally is gasping. No. There's a simple way to make the horse drink. And what is it? Put salt in his oats, and he's going to want to drink. He will be thirsty. Okay? If our goal, I'm finishing up here. If our goal is to transform our students, not just to give them information. That's where we started today. Teaching is about changing lives, not giving information. If our goal is to change their lives, that's not going to happen by pouring more information into them. It's not going to happen by filling up their water dish until it's running over and saying, look, there's plenty of water there. If they want to drink, they'll drink. If it really is about transforming them, I'm going to have to make them thirsty. I'm going to have to put salt in their oats. Then they are going to come to class and want to learn. Have you ever had a student who was so thirsty to learn something that they went out and found it on their own? Or they couldn't wait to get back to class to learn? That is our job as a teacher, is to give them a thirst for learning. One more story from Howard Hendricks. He said that he was the chaplain for the, I think it was the Dallas Cowboys. It was the Cowboys football organization. And he said one of the football players became a Christian, had never been a Christian. And Howard Hendricks talked to him and led him to Christ. And the football player said, "Now, Dr. Hendricks, what do I need to do next?" And Dr. Hendricks gave him a Bible. And he said, "Here, start reading this." So he saw him. I think he went over to Dallas once a month to meet with these. So a month later, he comes back, and he sees the guy. And the guy said, "I read it. Now what?" And he said, "Well, just keep reading more." And he said, "No, I read the whole thing." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I started here, and I read to here. Now what?" Dr. Hendricks said, in a year, this man read through the Bible 13 times, a professional football player who had never known Christ before. Why did he do that? He was thirsty. He found something in here that he'd never seen before, and he was thirsty. I read that story, and I thought, how many of our kids, what would happen to our young people? What would happen to our children if we could get them thirsty to know more about God's Word? Do you see what that would do for this problem at 18 when they leave and they never come back? Because now this would be something they were hungry. Do you understand what it would do for our teaching if they were coming to our classes asking questions because they were thirsty? So, as teachers, here's your homework assignment this week, this month. And I'll do like today. I will ask you to report next class. So hopefully we'll have several. I want you to think about your class, your age group, and come up with three ways that you could motivate your students to want to learn. Be as specific as you can. Three ways to motivate your young people, your kindergartners, your upper elementary, your adults. Three ways to motivate them to want to learn more. This kind of comes back to what you said, sister, about the group you're working with. How do I get them to want to do this? Not just holding their head under the water. How do I put salt in their oats? And next month we will talk about this motivation. Dear God, I thank you for this group, these teachers who are serving you and pouring time and effort into their students. Would you help us to be more effective teachers? Give us a vision for the students that you send to us. Give us a passion for transforming their lives. And then would you give us tools to use that will help us to guide them and to lead them to you. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Thank you. I am sorry. I meant to have time for discussion. I feel really bad when I say to you, don't lecture your whole class, and I spend 2 hours lecturing. I guess I need to slow down and just have more time. Next, I tell you what, let's do this. Next month, please come with comments, questions, things that you want to talk about from your situation, and I will just not plan to get through everything so that we can talk about it, because otherwise I am very much doing what I told you not to. A 2-hour lecture on why you shouldn't lecture. So come with some questions next month. And